This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. More than 50 years ago, a young man named John Lewis spoke to 200,000 people at the March on Washington in our nation's capital.
By the forces of our demand, our determination, and our numbers, we shall splinter the segregated South into 1,000 pieces and put them together in the image of God and democracy. We must say, wake up, America, wake up, for we cannot stop, and we will not and cannot be patient.
John Lewis is a pillar of the civil rights movement. He was born the son of sharecroppers in rural Pike County, Alabama, later became the president of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, better known as SNCC. John Lewis led nonviolent protests throughout the South. He is now a long-serving member of the United States Congress and telling his story in a unique fashion through the medium of a graphic novel. That novel is March, Book One, and it will be the theme for this year's Durham Reads Together. Congressman John Lewis and co-author Andrew Iden will be in town this Saturday for a public conversation about March. We had a chance to talk with him about the book last week. It's based in large part on John Lewis' autobiography, Walking with the Wind. I asked Congressman Lewis why he's retelling his story with a graphic novel.
Well, it is important that we try to reach another generation of young people to understand, to learn, to be inspired the way we were inspired by a little book called Martin Luther King Jr. and the Montgomery Story. It was a comic book. 14 pages, it sold for 10 cents. I read that little book back in 1958, and it set me on a path to commit myself to the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence, to change America.
And I guess it's an important time in a young man's life. We heard you at the March on Washington saying that you had run out of patience. That's the hallmark of a young person, and I suppose that's when we want to capture people's imagination. It's right at that moment if we're expecting change, I suppose. Am I right?
You're very much so right. I didn't like the signs that I saw that said white men, colored men, white women, colored women, white waiting. I would ask my mother, my father, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, why? And they would say, that's the way it is. Don't get in the way. Don't get in trouble. But that little comic book and listen to Rosa Parks, listen to Martin Luther King Jr. inspired me to find a way to get in the way, to get in trouble, good trouble, necessary trouble. So what I said at the March on Washington on August 28, 1963, I said, you tell us to wait. You tell us to be patient. We cannot wait. We cannot be patient. We want our freedom, and we want it now.
You were speaking to America, but you were also speaking to the civil rights movement at that time, which was led by Martin Luther King and the SCLC, that were also urging you to be patient and you to calm down a little bit. So there was even tension within the movement that you had to navigate as a young man. Tell us about that.
Well, there were some people in the movement, some lawyers and some older leaders telling us that we're trying to push too fast and there's some things that we shouldn't do or say. But we wanted to bring about what we call a nonviolent revolution, a revolution of values, a revolution of ideas. You can only be still so long. You see people who have been arrested and jailed and beaten. You saw people passing beautiful school buildings, riding broken down buses to school, and you had to be segregated, and you wanted to change that. What? Going downtown to the little town of Troy, Alabama, near where I grew up, on a Saturday afternoon to the theater. We, all of us little black children, had to go upstairs to the balcony, and all of the little white children went downstairs to the first floor. I didn't like it, and so I kept asking questions. And my mother just said to me, you're just nosy. You have a big head. You want to get in trouble. I just wanted to change things.
Andrew Iden, as a comic book fan yourself and now the co-author of March, Book One, what was it about Congressman Lewis's life that you thought would translate into a graphic novel?
Well, I grew up in Atlanta. Congressman Lewis has been my congressman since I was 3 years old. And even more so, when I started working for him, I came to understand his story as something of a guide for young people today. He was so young when he was a part of these seminal moments and led many of them. 23 when he spoke at the March on Washington, 25 when he led the Selma to Montgomery March. And being around that age myself when we first had this idea, I kept thinking, how do we inspire young people today to understand their own power? And there was no story that I'd ever heard that had more importance to young people than his in inspiring them and showing them that there is a way forward for them.
And I think one of the things, you know, for those of us who grew up around this time, we can see, we at least saw news footage of the march across the Pettus Bridge, and we could see news footage of these stories. So for us, the graphics were on our TV sets every night, and now we can remember them. But I guess it's really important for people who weren't there to get the visuals, to see what this looked like, to understand what folks like John Lewis actually had to go through.
Absolutely. You know, graphic novels today are almost ubiquitous. We see comic books and movies. We see, you know, they're treated as literature. They're in schools. They're everywhere. And yet the civil rights movement itself isn't. And that's not right. 47 states, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center's most recent report, fail to adequately teach the civil rights movement. And if graphic novels are going to be accepted in schools, there should be one there that adequately teaches that story. And as we've heard over and over and over again, it's not just a graphic novel that children are told to read, but it's one that they want to read.
Well, I think that's the other thing, John Lewis, is that for people who come to the civil rights movement and study it as a kind of a historical period, people like you and Martin Luther King and the other leaders of that movement sort of seem to have come full blown out of whole cloth as heroes and leaders. You had some very trying moments, and for you, even learning to become a member of a nonviolent movement was a very scary prospect for you, and at one point, you didn't think it was possible. Tell us about that.
Well, growing up and listening to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on the old radio and meeting him in person when I was 18, meeting Rosa Parks when I was 17, it inspired me, but as a student with other students, we studied the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence. Every Tuesday night at 6:30 p.m., a small group of students, black and white college students and some high school students, would meet at a church outside of Fisk University in downtown Nashville, where we studied over and over again. We had role playing. We had social drama. We studied what Gandhi attempted to accomplish in South Africa, what he accomplished in India. We studied Thoreau and civil disobedience. We studied Martin Luther King Jr. in Montgomery. And from time to time, there would be drama where people would pretending they were pouring hot water, or hot coffee, or hot chocolate on us, spitting on us, pulling us off the so-called stools at lunch counters and knocking us down. And that actually did happen during the sit-ins, during the Freedom Rides. But we grew to accept the way of nonviolence as a way of life, way of living.
Did you ever worry in the beginning of this training that you couldn't do it, that when people were spitting on you and calling you names, that you wouldn't be able to keep your hands at your side?
Well, I learned very early to make that commitment to the way of love, the way of peace, the way of nonviolence. And I never, ever thought or considered striking back. I wanted to be as disciplined as possible. I didn't want anything to hurt the movement.
Andrew, tell us a little bit about the collaboration and the people you worked with, including Congressman Lewis, to put the graphic novel together.
Well, this is a process unlike anything I've participated in. It was a lot of late nights, a lot of weekends, because Congressman Lewis and I work on his staff. We have day jobs. This was a period of time that we set aside that would normally be our free time because we believed in what we were doing. And as we talked it over, Congressman would tell me the stories. We would pull photographs and accounts from other places. And then we involve this unbelievable artist, Nate Powell, who is just one of his generation's great talents. And once that process began, we were all going back and forth, looking at pages, having these binders and these discussions on the phone. And it really became like we were a band of brothers. As the congressman says, we were a circle of trust working together to make this book happen.
Congressman Lewis, I wonder what it was like for you to see these drawings, these kind of graphic images, that you lived through this story. The rest of us saw it on television, those of us of a certain age. And now there's this graphic representation, these drawings. What was it like for you to see those pictures? Did it look like did it look like what you lived through?
Well, Andrew stated it so well. When you have an artist like Nate Powell, this young man had the ability to make it real, to make it plain. And at time when I saw some of the artwork, I almost cried. In March Book 1, there's the do's and don'ts of the sit-in movement in Nashville. And I remember so well the day of the first mass arrest, February the 27th, 1960, my first arrest. Each of us had a copy of the do's and don'ts saying, do sit up straight. Don't laugh out. Don't talk back. Obey your leader. The sign's so simple, but it was so meaningful. And every single one of us on that day made a commitment to the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence. 89 of us were arrested and went to jail. And when I was arrested, I felt good. I felt liberated. I felt like I had crossed over. So to see that in these drawings, it's so moving. He make it real. He bring it alive.
Here, Andrew, it's one thing to convey the conditions that drove men like John Lewis to take action, and I think that's maybe an easier thing for people to understand. The harder thing is what John just described, Congressman Lewis just described, the discipline it took to actually mount a successful nonviolent movement. Does this book, in a way, present sort of two different challenges, to present the conditions on the one hand and also the part that we never really thought about, what kind of discipline it takes to make a movement like this work?
Well, you can describe it as a challenge or you can describe it as an opportunity. I think today you see young people who are more frustrated than they have been in a generation. And they want to know how they can affect change themselves. And we see protest movements coming with Occupy, with what's going on in Ferguson, and most importantly, the development lately of the Ferguson syllabus that we're very excited to be a part of, because we try very, very hard to show the details of successful nonviolent resistance. And it is the details that matter. They were so disciplined and so orderly, particularly in Nashville, that it led to their greatest success. And today, young people need to understand that there is a process. There is a effective way to engage in nonviolent protest. And many of those core principles have been ignored in some of the most recent protests. And it's to their detriment. And hopefully, what we did in March, and many people have said they've found it to be very helpful in understanding what those core components are. You know, the do's and don'ts are a critical link to the past and how they did that, and it's something that you could print out and use today in your protests, and that's why we depicted it. The workshops, the hard work, the conditioning that these young people went through. We want it to stand as a how-to guide in many respects for young people today.
Well, Congressman Lewis, I wonder how you see it today, because if we look at protests in Ferguson and other places, they tend to be responses to particular events. The civil rights movement was a response to systemic violence against African Americans, systemic discrimination. Do we see it? In other words, if you're trying to organize a movement, you have to perceive that systemic injustice. Do we see it that way? Is there enough organization on the ground that you think young people see that kind of a problem or not?
Well, Ferguson and so many other efforts or movements, or what you may call a movement, just sort of pop up. But in so much of our efforts during the early 60s and the late 50s, it was a deliberate effort to have a movement from the ground up, not necessarily reaction to a particular incident. In Nashville, we wanted to build what we called the beloved community. It was this idea that we had to respect the dignity and the worth of every human being. So whether it was the sit-ins or the Freedom Rides or the march from Selma to Montgomery, before we engage in any type of protest, it was always that educational component that you had to be committed. If you couldn't make a commitment to the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence, you couldn't be included as a participant. And that was young people. That was students who said, I cannot adhere. So you can do something else. You can make signs. You can transport people to the protest site, but you cannot protest.
Is the education piece more difficult today, and to build a sustained organization of resistance more difficult today because the signs aren't as apparent? There aren't signs that say whites only, and yet evidence of discrimination is obvious, but it appears to be embedded in our criminal justice system. Harder to view as systemic. Is it harder to educate the public about these issues? And I'll start with you, Congressman Lewis.
Well, I think today it should be easier because you have the new technology. We didn't have a website. We hadn't heard of the internet. We didn't have a fax machine. We had an old mimeograph machine. In many communities and neighborhoods, we didn't have a regular telephone. We had a party line. But we used what we had. And I think today, young people are much more prepared. They just need the tools. They need the instrument. They need to be educated. They need to know something about discipline. The way we even dress back in the 60s. I remember when I wanted to go down and protest on that day that we heard that we might be arrested, I wanted a new suit. I didn't have much money. But I went to a used men's store and bought a used suit. And I paid only $5 for it. And a few days ago, Andrew discovered a copy of the photograph of me being arrested in Nashville for the first time. And I tell you, I look very good in that $5 suit.
Let me ask you this. I know you've been around touring with this book. You've been to Comic-Cons and been to classrooms. How are young people responding to the book, Congressman?
Well, I tell you, it's amazing to me. It is just outright amazing. The way young people are reading the book. It's not just young people, not just children, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, middle school students, high school or college, but adults are reading the book all over. I know Andrew can speak to the fact that several colleges and universities have made it required reading.
Yeah, I think it's important that these schools are using it in that way because that's also where I think the next central front will be. Student loans today are perhaps the greatest scourge to activism that there is. Young people are burdened with a debt unlike any generation before them, before they even complete their education. And in order for there to be a true activist class, again, as there were with the young people in SNCC, we're going to have to tackle that. The federal government has an obligation to make it more affordable to get a high-quality education. And the way the student loan system is set up today, they're not giving that. And that's going to hold protesters back. And I believe it is perhaps the single greatest challenge facing this generation at the moment in order for them to fully liberate themselves and explore their power as an activist class.
I want to thank you both for being on the program. Andrew Iden is a congressional staffer and co-author of March, Book 1. Congressman John Lewis represents Georgia's 5th Congressional District. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Andrew and Congressman Lewis will be in Durham this weekend as participants in the Durham Reads Together kickoff. You can hear them at 2:30 BN Duke Auditorium at North Carolina Central University. Then this Sunday afternoon, Congressman Lewis and I will hold a public conversation at the Hayti Heritage Center in Durham. For full details, go to our website, stateofthings.org.